We don't take lightly the fact of so many of you served, you men and women served in our armed forces. In fact, this is why we're able to come and openly worship, is because you were willing to make that sacrifice. And I want you to know from the bottom of our hearts how much and how deeply we appreciate that. You know, as nice as ocean breeze and palm trees and sand is, it's much nicer seeing all of you. Just want you to know that. And you notice I left out sand because I don't like sand. But the other stuff is really nice, but it is good to be home and with you again. And Josh, young bucks or young whatever you said, you passed that, buddy. I'm sorry. I hate to tell you that, but those days are over. Back in the 1980s, just a short time ago, you know, I've shared stories before about our infamous VW bus. The headache of my life for several years. Seemed like every trip, every vacation, or wherever we were going, meant that before we could go, I had to work on the car and get it running again. And then when we get to wherever we were going, I'd have to spend part of that time working on it some more to get it running good enough to get back home. One thing about VW, it did keep you on your knees because the engine was in the back and you had to work on your knees most of the time. But I grew to hate that car and constantly wondering what was going to happen next. And one day I just had to have enough. You know, you ever reach that point where it's like, I'm done. I've had enough. We are going car shopping. And so I spent a little time figuring out our finances and what we could afford. And we lived in the mountains of Virginia at the time, and the nearest decent car dealership, which was known for fairly good prices, was about an hour and a half away. So we got in the VW van and we headed down the mountain and got to the dealership about an hour and a half and spent a little time, not too much time, but looking around at cars, mostly vans, because when you have a family of six, you need a big car. And it did not take very long to figure out that what I figured we could afford, we were not going to find a car for that amount of money. And so I was about to give up, about to leave, when the salesman walked over to us and said, hey, let me show you this car. I should have refused, but I didn't. And so we walked over, and he showed us this two-year-old brown and tan Dodge Ram van, only had 18,000 miles on it. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. It was definitely out of our price range, but it was beautiful. At least I thought it was out of our price range until the salesman started to work his magic, you know, running the numbers, reworking the finances. Oh, you think I'm talking about the car salesman? No, I'm talking about the salesman named Paul Kennedy that said, I want this car. Very bad. I started reworking all those numbers in my head, and it didn't really take me very long to decide that, well, we really could afford this car payment that I'm about to make. And now my wife questioned my math skills. That might have been the beginning of core math, I don't know. But she questioned my skills, and we talked a little bit about that, but I was determined. In fact, this was the car God wanted us to have. I must admit, I never talked to him about it, but I'm sure that I wanted it so bad, I was sure he had to agree with me. And so we signed the papers and got in the car and drove home. It felt so nice. I mean, the engine purred. I knew I was going to make it home okay without stopping and fixing something. The upholstery looked almost brand new. It's the first time we ever had cloth upholstery. Remember the vinyl stuff you'd sit on in the summertime that would soak your back by the time you'd stick to it? It hurt to get off of it. I was thrilled with this car. In fact, I think about midnight I got up and looked out the window, make sure it was there. It really was. I didn't dream about it. But then about 3 in the morning, I woke up from my sleep and suddenly said to myself, what have I done? I've made a terrible decision. And I had that decision that I figured out put our family in financial jeopardy. In fact, because of my poor decision, we would struggle for the next 5 years. That's 60 months. That's 1,825 days. That's, 40,000, never mind, you get the idea. I felt terrible. You know, I felt bad because I got sucked into doing that, for one thing. But especially, I think what bothered me the most was that decision impacted my whole family. There was no getting around it. For the next 5 years, it made us tight. We struggled. And I'm the one that did bills every month. So every month I'd see that, you know, that book with thick pen and all these payments that had to be made. And every month I was reminded, you dummy, what were you thinking? And like I say, my family had to suffer as well just because of the decision I had made. I bring that up because we've been spending some time looking at King David. We're looking at his portions of his life. At the time, actually, we haven't got to the point yet where he's actually got to the throne, but he's been anointed as the next king. God's made it clear that David is his choice as the next king. The prophet of God, Samuel, came to him and anointed him as king. So all that has taken place, but so far, he still is not on the throne. In fact, at this moment, he's having a hard time believing he will even survive long enough to make it to the throne. Things are not looking good from him, and we kind of walked through that, just a little bit of a review. It started with him getting word that King Solomon had put a contract out on his life, and remember he talked to his best friend Jonathan, who is also King Saul's son, and said, you know, is this true? Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you warn me? And Jonathan said, I didn't know, and they checked on it, and sure enough, it was true. And so from that, he made the next decision to flee for his life. Obviously, he had to get out of there if the king and the soldiers and everybody's out for David, so he fleed for his life. He ran, and at first it looked like, as we were looking at it, maybe he was making a right decision, because first place he went was to remember the priest at Nob. And so you're thinking, well, good, he's going to go and ask God what he should do, but that's not why he went, remember? He had decided what he should do. So he went to the priest, and in David's mind, if he just had some supplies and a weapon, he could take care of the problem himself. And so that's what he went for, and he lied over and over again to the priest in order to get some bread and a sword before he moved on. So he's making these decisions. He's in this bad spot. So from Nob and from his discussion with the priest, now he had a priest, he had supplies, and he had a sword. And so he ran again. He's getting panicky. He decides that he's not even safe in his own country. So he goes over to the Philistines' country, their territory. They're the enemy. And thinking to himself, well, maybe I can switch sides. Maybe I can be protected there. And maybe they'll be glad to have a warrior switch sides. That'd be something they'd celebrate. But it wasn't. Remember, the king found out, his advisor said, this is the guy that's been killing us. He's the guy that they sing this song about David's killed his 10,000s and Saul's killed his thousands. We can't let him into our army. We can't let him into seeing what we're planning and what our strategies are. And David all of a sudden realized he'd made a big mistake. His decision making wasn't in good shape. And so in order to get out of that situation, because he thought he was going to be killed, remember he pretended he was crazy. He was a madman. The Bible says he drooled down his beard. He scratched on the door. And the king finally says, "Why do I need another madman around here? Send him away." And so David escaped again. And then he made a decision, his own decision again. I need to hide out somewhere. And that's where we got to last week. He went and found this cave, and he hid out in this cave, just decision after decision, trying to deal with his situation, trying to think through, how should I handle this? What should I do next? And every time he did something, every time he turned a direction, every time he reacted, it seemed to get worse. He dug his hole deeper. Now we find him in a cave, alone. And finally, he turns to God. Albeit not in such a godly or respectful way, but nevertheless, he turned finally to God. Look for God's perspective of his situation. And so we're going to start. We're going to eventually end up in 1 Samuel 22. But we're going to start this morning in Psalm, the book of Psalm, chapter 142, and we're going to read something that David wrote while he was in that cave. And you're going to see a bit of his heart in a situation and his desperation as he finally, after making a series of really bad decisions in his circumstances, as he finally turns to God. Psalm 142, let's start with verse 1. In verse 1, you'll see it starts with this statement, a maskil of God when he was in the cave, a prayer. And what we believe, that word maskil, we're not sure exactly what it means. What we think it means is that in that cave, David wrote this prayer out and later put it to song, and it became a song that they would sing, one of the songs in the book of Psalms. So follow along as I read now, starting with verse 1. Psalm 142, a maskil of David, when he was in the cave, a prayer. I cry aloud to the Lord. I lift my voice to the Lord for mercy. Verse 2, I pour out my complaint before him. Before him I tell my trouble. Verse 3, when my spirit grows faint within me, it is you who know my way. In the path where I walk, men have hidden a snare for me. Look to my right and see. No one's concerned for me. I have no refuge. No one cares for my life. Verse 5, I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you're my refuge, my portion of the land of living. Listen to my cry, for I am in a desperate need. Rescue me from those who pursue me, for they are too strong for me. Verse 7, set me free from my prison that I may praise your name. Then the righteous will gather about me because of your goodness to me. You hear David's anguish, his fear, his frustration. Do you hear where his mind is regarding his circumstances at the moment? He says, I pour out my complaint. Remarkable. He's sitting alone in the cave because of the decisions he has made, one after another. There have been his decisions, his reactions, his poor choices. That's what's put him in that cave. But in such humanity, so often as we are as well, he's angry at God. I pour out my complaint. Those are his honest emotions at the moment. God, this is all your fault. If you hadn't brought up this whole king thing, none of this would have happened. This is all started right back there when you said I was going to be king. You know, one of the things I love about scriptures, and I've said this often, is they don't gloss over humanity. They don't try to pretend that the people that God used were more than they were. They weren't superhuman. They weren't somehow super godly. They didn't always get it wrong, right? Sometimes they got it very wrong. And yet in the midst of that, God continues to love and protect and use them. Use ungodly men to make bad, and women that made bad choices, and still he uses them. And I need to hear that once in a while. I don't know about you. Often in spite of ourselves, we get ourselves in all kinds of situations. And he still loves us. And he still uses us. And he still protects us. David said, God, this is all your fault. In fact, he said, my spirit grows faint. I'm done. I'm at the end of my rope. I can't handle this anymore. Ever said that? I just can't handle this anymore. God, this is overwhelming. And on top of that, I'm alone in this. I'm all by myself. No one is concerned for me. I have no refuge. No one cares. In fact, I'm reading between the lines with this, but I could hear David thinking to himself, man, if I could just be back with the sheep, you know, things were so much simpler there. You know, I knew who the enemy was, and sheep were, they just followed me around. And yeah, oh, if I could just be back to those simpler days. You know, I got to confess, you teens, they're I know there are times in your life where you feel like life is pretty complicated for you, and that's a reality, feels like it. And once in a while we'll hear you say things like, I can't wait to get on my own. I can't wait when to have my own place, you know. I get my own car, do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it. And you know what your parents are saying to themselves? Oh man, I wish I was a teen again, when I didn't have to worry about rent and car payment and car repairs and groceries and doctor bills and paying for insurance. And that's a normal day, let alone the unexpected things that come along down the road that we didn't know was going to happen. But David's definitely not experiencing a normal day here. I suspect he's longing for something like that. Mary Lou used to ask me on a regular basis, she's quit now, but she used to ask me, when are we going to have a normal week? And I'd say, I think next week looks like it's going to be pretty normal. And then finally I said, hey, Mary Lou, this is our normal. Let's get used to it. David's not experiencing normal, and I expect he's longing for something like that, but the reality is he is in a cold, dark cave, all alone, afraid for his life, feeling very sorry for himself. He's there because of choices that he has made, and somehow feeling like this is God's problem, God's fault. Very human emotions, which God allows to be recorded for us to read. It's just not worth it, God. It's not worth it. But again, David's in this spot, deep emotional dark period of David's life, not as because of the consequences of God's will. Did God anoint David king? Yes, he did. And did that at least play into Saul's jealousy of him? Yeah, it did. I'm sure also the fact that he was a very successful warrior, but that was part of God's blessing. But that didn't help his relationship, and those people singing that crazy song really hurt things. And then on top of that, Saul seeing that his own son loved David so much, all those things played into it. But the reality is the physical and emotional cave that David finds himself in at this moment is not the result of the circumstances of David's life. Let me repeat that. It's not a result of the circumstances of his life. And when you and I get in that cave and we think to ourselves, if these things weren't happening in my life, I wouldn't be here. I'm telling you, it's not a result of the circumstances of your life either, or of my life. Truth is, David's going to deal with much harder things in the future, much more heartbreaking. His own son someday is going to try to kill him, chase him off the throne and out of town. Much bigger things. And he's going to come through those situations strong, head held high, confident. David's issue isn't his circumstances. We tend to think it is. David's issue is his confidence, who he trusts. Up to this point, he's been trusting himself, his decisions, his reactions, his response, his plans. And all that's led to is worse consequences. But consequences are not the problem. The problem is who he trusts. And the same is often for you. The same for you and I. And sometimes, like David, we have to get desperate, beside ourselves, finally get to the point where we understand, okay, this is too big. This is too big for me. I've tried everything I know to try, and it hasn't worked. It's too big for me, God. Listen to what David said. Listen to my cry. I am in desperate need. Rescue me from those who pursue me, for they are too strong for me. See, up to this point, David has followed his own actions and reactions, his perspective. He's done what he thought should happen. He thought, you know, give me some supplies, give me a weapon, and I can handle my situation. I can handle what I'm up against. And he found out he couldn't. I go over to the enemy. They're going to welcome me. They're going to welcome a warrior like me. And he found out that was not the case. And now he's in this cave, deserted, abandoned, alone, abandoned by everyone except the one who's still listening for his cry, God. He didn't know that to that moment, but finally, he calls on God. Now, it's a complaint at first. He complains to God. But you know what? You look in Scripture, God never chastises him for that. Never any rebuke for starting his call to God that way. God, I'm complaining about you. I have my complaint. You're not taking good care of me. God never chastises him for that. He's just glad that his son has finally come to him, has finally realized, God, this is too big for me. In his book, Wild at Heart, that's a book, by the way, that I think every man should read. Every woman married to a man should read. Every woman mother of sons should read. John Eldridge writes in that book, though, that something that I think fits right into what we're talking about. Listen, most of us have been misinterpreting life and what God is doing for a long time. I think I'm just trying to get God to make my life work easier, a client of mine confessed. But he could have been speaking for most of us. We're asking the wrong questions. Most of us are asking, God, why did you let this happen to me? Or, God, why won't you just fill in the blank, help me succeed, get my kids straightened out, fix my marriage, you know, what you've been whining about. But to enter into a journey of initiation with God requires a new set of questions. Questions like this: what are you trying to teach me here? What issues in my heart are you trying to raise through this? What is it you want me to see? What are you asking me to let go of? In truth, God has been trying to initiate you for a long time. What is in the way is how you've mishandled your wound and the life you've constructed as a result. So here it is. Until we come to the place, to oversimplify it with a cliche, that we let go and let God, where we give God the reins, where we trust his plan, even with the hard things, where we truly accept his will as the best, as what is good, even in painful times. Until that happens, we will continually find ourselves, time after time, in the cave. David had to learn that. You and I have to learn that. In David's case, he had to get desperate first. And when he was desperate, when he called on God, even complaining at first, God responded. And he always will. Which brings us up to today's message. That was all introduction. So now, I'm kidding. But go over with me to 1 Samuel 22. Book of 1 Samuel 22. And I want to read verses 1 through 5. This is where we actually left off a couple weeks ago. It starts off with David in the cave. Verse 1, David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. But notice what happens. When his brothers and his father's household heard about it, they went down to him there. What was David crying out in his prayer as he's alone in that cave? He says, I'm all alone. I have no refuge. Nobody cares for me. And yet God, I believe, had already sent. The family was on the way to join him. God knew what he needed before he even admitted that he needed anything. God already knew what he needed, and he sent his family to be with him. Verse 2, all those who were in distress or in debt or discontent gathered around him, and he became their leader. About 400 men were with him, and that's just the men. There are also women and children. He's not alone anymore. In fact, at this point, you might be feeling, this cave is a little too small for all these people. I kind of went overboard there, didn't you, God? But God knew. He says, I'm alone. He says, oh, no. A couple days from now, you're going to be saying, wait a minute, what are we going to do with all these people? Verse 3, from there, David went to Mizpah in Moab and said to the king of Moab, would you let my father and my mother come to stay and stay with me and stay with you until I learn what God will do for me? Let me read those last words again. Until I learn what God will do for me. What God will do. Now, till I figure out my next plan, my next step, how I need to handle this situation. He's finally got to the point where he's saying, God, what do you want me to do? Verse 4, so he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. Verse 5, but the prophet of God said to David, do not stay in the stronghold. Go into the land of Judah. So David left and went to the forest of Herod. David finally got it. It was not the stronghold that was going to protect him. It was not supplies. It was not having weapons. It was not a different set of friends. It was not his own skill or wit or strength or even his own resolve that would protect him and take care of him. His stronghold was God and God's will. So he left the cave and went back to Judah. Now you think about it. That is back to the enemy's territory. That's King Saul's territory. But that's where God told him to go. Back into the center of what seemed like the worst place he could possibly go, but it was actually the safest place because it's where God wanted him to be. The God who had promised him that he would be king. And now, because he's following the will of God and trusting God for his provision and his protection, he obeys. How about you? What cave do you find yourself in right now? How about me? Where are we today? Maybe if you're in a cave, maybe part of the question you should be asking yourself, and I should ask myself, is, well, who is it that's running my show anyway? Whose plan am I following? Who do I trust? Do I trust my own wits? Do I trust what everybody else is saying? Do I trust what I see in the world of politics or the finances or the stock market? Who do I trust? Who or what am I trusting in? Maybe it's time to cry out in the cave, God, rescue me. Rescue me. God is a rescuer. He saw our need, what sin had done to us, how it had destroyed our relationship with him and our own lives and even all of creation. He saw all of that. And he stepped into our world to rescue us. If you need on the elements, put your hand up and Josh will bring them around to you. He stepped into our world to rescue us. First, by allowing himself to be arrested in the garden. And from there, being taken to a very unethical, illegal trial to be beaten, Isaiah says, beyond recognition. His body would be broken for us. When we take communion, we remember our rescuer who allowed his body to be broken. Let's eat the bread together. And then, in order to rescue us from our own sin's consequences, the separation that our sin had caused to come between us and our God, the separation that would go on for eternity if someone didn't step in there and take our place, die on our behalf, but someone had that did that would have to be innocent. He couldn't have sin of his own. And so our Savior Jesus allowed himself to be hung on that cross, shed his blood, breathe his last breath to rescue us from our sin and to provide a way for us to be forgiven. Let's drink the cup together. Pray with me. Father, we're so grateful. Thank you for, first of all, I'm amazed that you're so open and honest in your word with us about the struggles we have as humanity. And to be Noah, we read about David, and at first glance we may start to think, oh, how could he do that? And then we start thinking about ourselves. We realize, no, I see how he can do it. I do the same thing. I get myself in circumstances and trouble. I make bad decisions that not only cost me, that cost others as well. And then I blame you. And yet, you're standing ready to rescue because you love us. You love every person in this room that much. You're just waiting for us to call on you so that you can step in and do what needs to be done. It's not our circumstances that put us in the cave. It's our confidence in you as our God. If our trust is in ourselves, if it's in all these other powers that to be in the world around us, we're going to find ourselves often alone, discouraged, disheartened, feeling like failures. Our trust has to be in you. You're the rescue. Thank you for that reminder this morning through this passage. Pray these things in your Son's name. Amen.
Well, church, we're going to stand together, sing one last chorus before we go. And I believe our prayer team, Tom, will be up here. If you need prayer over anything, they'd be glad to pray with you this morning.
Jesus, Messiah. Above all names, blessed Redeemer, Emmanuel,
the rescue,
for sinners, the ransom from hell. Jesus Messiah, Lord of all. Jesus Messiah, Lord of all.
Church, thanks for worshiping with us. Hope you have a great week.